From WEMU at American University in Washington, this is Public Interest. I'm Kojo Namdi. He's the man who once quipped that Truman Capote's death was a good career move. He feels that whenever a friend succeeds, a little something in me dies. To him, the Wall Street Journal is a cheery neo-fascist paper, and our country should be called the United States of Amnesia. For more than half a century, Gore Vidal has stretched and challenged our notions of politics, history, sexuality, and humanity. In his latest book, the concluding novel of his best-selling American Chronicle series, Gore Vidal weaves the historical events of World War II and the Cold War around the politics of Washington, the Hollywood film industry, and the cultural centers of New York. In this hour, we'll talk with this prolific novelist, essayist, playwright, politician, historian, Gore Vidal, about his career and high-profile life. Mr. Vidal, welcome.
Very nice to be back in my hometown of Washington, D.C.
Indeed, you do consider this your hometown, even though technically you were born at West Point. You grew up here in Washington, and you have already selected a spot in Rock Creek Park here where you wish to be buried. Why?
Because Henry Adams is nearby, and he was our greatest historian and a profound influence, well, really, on American history writers. It's also a nice place, and I think it's, after all, for somebody who wrote the novel Washington, D.C., it would be a good terminal place to be out there. It's beautiful. Rock Creek Cemetery is very, very beautiful.
I love the park generally. I do all of my jogging in Rock Creek Park.
Oh, yeah.
The number to call to join this conversation with Gore Vidal is 1-800-433-8850. You can email us at pi@wamu.org. This new book, The Golden Age, is described as a historical novel. It says right here on the book jacket, a novel, but I frankly consider you more of a historian than a historical novelist. And you, in the end of this book, try to merge that distinction, if you will. Can you explain what, in your view, is the relationship between a historical novelist and history?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I set 7 novels in American history telling the story of a single family, which is fictional, but mingling with the real characters of our history from the Revolution right up to the year 2000. When I do the real people, the people who've actually lived, I am as accurate as I can be. Whatever they say or do is pretty much what we have agreed that they said and did. The fictional characters are there to speculate on motive, something historians ought not to do and seldom, thank heavens, dare do. They're there to tell a story, the neutral story of what the past was all about. But when you bring in, it's like bringing in music into an opera libretto. The fictional characters can speculate and give you odd angles of what Franklin Roosevelt was really like. You were just talking about Rock Creek Cemetery here in town. One of the most beautiful things in the city is Henry Adams, the great historian and descendant of 2 presidents, had a beautiful monument made to his wife in the center of the park. Grief. Nobody can tell. They don't know whether it's a boy or a girl. Actually, it's a life-size statue of a young man wearing something over his head, mourning. And Eleanor Roosevelt told me that whenever times got really bad for her in the White House, she would drive over to Rock Creek Cemetery, and they have a marble seat so that you can look at grief and contemplate whatever it is you want to contemplate. So for historical novels, I suspect I am probably much more of a historian in these stories than a novelist. But the fictional stories do drive the plot. And we get to see, particularly in The Golden Age, This is a close-up of Franklin Eleanor Roosevelt, Harry Hopkins, from 1940 on to Harry Truman, who comes in when Roosevelt dies in 1945, and starts the Cold War, and with Dean Acheson at his side. And I tell that story, too. I've called this the United States of Amnesia because nobody is remembered, and history is so badly taught in the schools. Our textbooks are dreadful. And as a result, kids just don't like history. And they do every year Purdue does a study of high school students and what subjects do they like and what don't they like. History always is the most disliked, American history, of all their studies. It comes in number 50 every year. Well, that's tragic. We have a very interesting history, and it takes genius to make it boring. It really takes genius. Happily, we have a lot of genius around who write textbooks.
So it would appear, but the historical novel is once again emerging as apparently a favorite reading, part of the reading material of the United States. You seem to feel that that has a great deal to do with the collapse of socialism in Eastern Europe and the end of the Cold War. Why?
I don't see much correlation there. The collapse of socialism, or to be precise, communism. Socialism continues.
True.
Even in the land of the free. What else is Social Security? I remember when Social Security came in, 1935, my grandfather introduced it in the Senate, and the Republicans all said, they were against Social Security, and they said, if this goes through, you will no longer have a name, only a number. Your name was to be stripped away from you. They said, this is communism. I wish we had a bit more socialism, like a good educational system or a health system for
healthcare
everybody.
System.
All civilized countries have it, but we're not allowed. So I think any turning to history by America, some American readers have always been fascinated by our history. I find readers in general, at least the ones who bother to write to me, are fascinated by their own families. And I get an awful lot of genealogical requests. I'll mention General Arnold in a book, and then somebody said, well, he was my great-great-grandfather, and did you know, or do you know? So I've got some interesting mail.
But you don't see a relationship between the end of the Cold War and this revived interest in the historical novel. I thought you might have, because so many people have said that during the Cold War and during the era of communism in Eastern Europe, we here were so concerned about our present and our future that we didn't pay a great deal of attention to our history.
I don't think that was the case at all. What we got was the most intense propaganda, which is what the Golden Age is about. How Harry Truman deliberately terrified the American people that the Russians were coming. The Russians were not coming. He knew it. Everybody who was informed knew it. The Russians were a second world power with a first world nuclear capacity at the end. They were not going anywhere, but in order to turn the United States into a national security state, he had to have an enemy. And they decided, since Stalin was a disagreeable figure and a tyrant to his own people, that he was on the march. He was going to conquer Europe. Well, he had no intention of conquering Europe. He wanted normal relations with us, and Roosevelt had promised him that at Yalta. A year or two later, Truman's president, and he goes back on the Yalta agreements at Potsdam. And Stalin, they had agreed at Yalta that he would get $20 billion in reparations. Russia had been wrecked. Truman went back on that. Then he organized the three sections of Germany, France, Britain, and the U.S., into the West German Republic, and gave the poor part, Prussia, to Stalin. And Stalin was fit to be tied, because they had agreed that the four powers would govern jointly a united Germany. And that was the beginning of the Cold War. And when it was proposed to leaders of Congress, Senator Vandenberg, a Republican, said, well, if this danger is as great as you say it is, we'll give you the military buildup you want, we'll give you NATO, we'll give you the CIA, we'll give you all these things. But you've got to scare the hell out of the American people, because we can't justify spending this amount of money. Truman did.
Gore Vidal's latest historical novel is called The Golden Age. It takes us from the beginning of World War II to the end of the Korean War, and it is the concluding novel in your series, the seventh. Why do you end in 1954?
I don't. Actually, I take it further on. I take it to the year 2000 in a final chapter or two. A couple of the characters are still alive, as is the author, and I enter the story at the end. So we have some sense of what the new year of the new millennium, 2000, was like, and where we were and where we'd come from. And there's a general pattern from the very beginning of expansion, from our wars against the Indians as of 1776, where I start the story with Burr, and then Jefferson acquiring the Louisiana Purchase, which gives us over a third of the continent. And Empire, which is about the fourth book in the series, is Teddy Roosevelt, and how we picked a war with Spain and then took over the Spanish Empire, which gave us the Philippines, and the Philippines made us a great Pacific power. There is a pattern all through these books, and I wrote them to discover the pattern. I don't start with a proposition and then try and sell it or dramatize it. I start with a search. How did we end up with a global nuclear empire in the year 2000? Well, by the time I got through the seven books, I have a pretty good idea. And the subtitle for the whole series is called Narratives of Empire.
Indeed, it traces how we go from republic to empire. But you mentioned Burr, and in Burr, you talked about the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, the intimate aspects of that relationship, for which you were roundly denounced by a number of critics at the time. Talk a little bit about the fact that the DNA now shows that there was, in fact, a relationship and there were, in fact, children. Again, the notion that a historical novel that takes an icon such as Thomas Jefferson and talks about his personal life simply should not be done.
Well, it was embarrassing for what I call the court historians, you know, who have nothing but these great icons that they keep dusting all the time. Everybody knew, particularly here in Washington, where what was then called Negro society, black society, I mean high society, was dominated by the Jefferson family. And everybody in town, the white people in town, just wouldn't believe it. You know, how on earth, why do they say they belong to the family? Well, they were. They were descendants of Thomas Jefferson through Sally Hemings, his slave girl, who was also the half-sister of his white wife, who was dead. So I used a novelist's, how shall I put it, courage, to say something the historians would not say. Burr was written in 1972 or 3, and as recently as that, this was kept a secret. The black community certainly knew about it, but it couldn't be published. And I show, I have some scenes with Burr and Jefferson and Sally Hemings all at Monticello. Dumas Malone, a nice old thing, but a bit of a fool, had done a six-volume life of Jefferson, and he attacked me, attacked Burr.
Before you finish telling that story, because we have to go to a break, but it has a great deal to do with what gentlemen did and did not do. And Gore Vidal will continue that story after this break. We're talking about his new historical novel, The Golden Age, the seventh and final in his continuing series on American Empire. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. You can email us at pi@wamu.org. We'll be right back.
Boston area will soon be home to yet another institution of higher learning. So what will make this one stand out? Among other things, the cost.
Counselors that we talk to are flabbergasted. And what they say typically is, oh, you're just going to be free for the first year or two, right? I said, nope, we're going to be full tuition and scholarship forever.
I'm David Brancaccio with a sneak peek at an engineering school any paying parent could love. Later on Marketplace from PRI.
Listen to Marketplace weeknights at 6 on WAMU 88.5 FM.
Listeners support WAMU, as does Politics and Prose, presenting Beyond the Screen, the Social and Cultural Effects of the Internet, featuring Paulina Borsuk and David Rosen, Tuesday, September 26th at 7 p.m.
Welcome back to our conversation with Gore Vidal about his new historical novel, The Golden Age. In his series on American Empire, this is the concluding historical novel in that series. You can join us, 1-800-433-8850. You can also email us at pi@wamu.org. Gore Vidal, you were talking about exactly how historians viewed your Burr novel when you talked about the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
Well, they took a dim view, and what I did, I based the fact that Sally Hemings at 14 or 15 was a slave girl belonging to Jefferson at Monticello, and she was also, her father had been Jefferson's father-in-law, so she was the half-sister of his white wife who had died. There's no doubt in anybody's mind except the professional historians who try to make icons out of these figures of the past, and they won't hear anything. Dumas Malone, the Jefferson scholar, denounced me. He said my portrait of Jefferson was subversive. And he said no gentleman of the 18th century could ever have had sexual relations with a slave. Since Mr. Jefferson was the greatest greatest gentleman of the 18th century America, he could never have had an affair with her. This is what we call a false syllogism. You create a false notion and then you apply it. Well, I got very interested in it when I read Madison Hemings' book, and he was Sally Hemings' son. Jefferson was his father. And James Madison, President Madison, and Dolly Madison were his godparents. And he wrote a book about growing up at Monticello as a slave boy in the house of his father and mother. She ended up, I think, she was in Aberdeen, Maryland, is where Sally ended up. And some of the family stayed right here in Washington. When I was a kid, they were the leaders of what was then called Negro society. Madison went out to Midwest and became a farmer, and then he wrote a memoir, which I highly recommend to anyone listening who wants to know what it was like to be a slave at Monticello, knowing that President Jefferson is your father.
And so much of what you have written in this series of novels has to do with what you knew growing up in Washington, D.C., what was whispered but known to be true. One of the things you talk about in The Golden Age is how Franklin Roosevelt provoked the Japanese into bombing the United States, even though he wasn't exactly sure necessarily exactly where it would happen. And you say that in those days, it was common knowledge in Washington that that's what he was doing.
Well, Washington was, well, it still is in many ways, a small town. The political class all know each other. They all have a pretty good idea of what everybody's up to. And we knew that Roosevelt was trying desperately to get us into the war as of 1940. France had fallen. England was being smashed to bits by the Nazis. And he, somewhat virtuously, wanted to go to war on England's side. But 80% of the American people did not want to go and fight in Europe. We had been stung in 1917, and they saw no reason for a replay. Roosevelt then worked it out that the Japanese, who were invading China and had taken conquered Manchuria, were definitely going to be the imperial power of the Pacific, which we thought we were with the Philippines and Hawaii. So he did a series of provocations, and if you want to read more about it, there's a book called Day of Deceit, published by Simon & Schuster, by an R.J. Stinnett, who spent years studying this case. And in 1995, under the Freedom of Information Act, we got all of the Japanese codes. We knew where their ships were all the time. Now, Roosevelt defenders say, well, he expected an attack. They must attack first. As he said to Harry Hopkins, if we attack them, they'll say Roosevelt got us into the war. They must make the first move. So he kept challenging them and challenging them. Finally, in August of 41, he sent them an ultimatum. And they had two ambassadors over here, and Cordell Hull read them the Riot Act. And he ordered them out of China. They'd been trying to conquer China since 37. And turned off their oil supply. They got their oil from us and scrap metal. And that tore it, and they then blew up the fleet at Pearl Harbor. Arguably, he thought it would probably be Manila, which would not have been so bad in our view. Some say he was startled by Pearl Harbor, others say not. But the most important piece, smoking gun, is 1 week before Pearl Harbor. He wrote his Wendell Willkie, who'd been the Republican candidate for president in the third term election of 1940, said, we will probably be attacked before Monday. And, of course, we were attacked on Sunday. Well, if he'd written Wendell Willkie that, why didn't he write the commanders at Pearl Harbor that we might be attacked?
A lot of your critics have attacked you for portraying your real-life characters in what they feel are less than human terms by making them cold and calculating. You talk in this book, The Golden Age, about Harry Hopkins saying, well, after this is over, there's only one place left to go, and that's the world.
Yes.
And Caroline Sanford says, are you serious? You sound a lot like they say Hitler sounds. And he said, well, that's the reality. That's what we're going after, the world.
You know, power is a drive in all human beings, more aggravated in those who become president than in others. And I have a hunch that, you know, an empire, it's what they call in, is it biology, a tropism. It's a growing organism. And if it doesn't keep growing, it shrinks and it dies and it comes to entropy. It freezes. It lacks energy. When you are on a roll as a nation, then you are on the move. History is nothing but the story of the migration of tribes, one tribe taking over another tribe, taking its territory away. What we have done, and this is why it's sad that we don't have proper historians, or we have proper historians, but they're not taught in the schools. The reality of what we have done in the course of 200 years, which was to create a global empire, nobody's ever done that before because they didn't have the technical means. We are 10 times as great in size as the Romans ever dreamed of being. Well, I think it would be a good notion. You know, the American people sometimes get very restive when they think that they have bad educational system for the ordinary people, those without money. We have no health care. We have nothing. We get nothing back. For all of our tax money, we pay quite a lot to the government. All we get are weapons. We get war. We get dominion over other countries. We're at this, as we sit here chatting, you and I, there we are down in Colombia getting ready to destroy what was a nice democratic country at one point because we want to stop drugs. We have no interest in stopping drugs. It's to help the warlords down there and keep our military machine active.
We're talking with Gore Vidal. His latest historical novel is called The Golden Age. You talk about the national security state, and even as we talk about that, there are people who are preparing to demonstrate at the meeting of the World Bank because they say what we have is really a corporate state. A state in which the major corporations get most of the benefits of what we produce. What do you see as the relationship between the two phenomena?
They are the same thing. The corporate state finances the national security state. By always saying the Russians are coming, or terrorists are coming, or drugs are coming, and we must arm, and you must give us all your money to General Electric, say, in order to build nuclear weapons. That's how you do business. So when they say corporate state, what they've done now is changed the name. National Security State is precisely what we are, armed to the teeth since 1950. And we have been at war for the last 50 years, hot, cold, and tepid, Over about 100 times with 100 enemies. The enemy of the month club, Gaddafi one month, Saddam the next one, Noriega. I mean, it's the enemy of the month club. The CIA picks an enemy, and then we dramatize him in the media. He's all evil, and we've put more money for our defense and to remove him. And finally, we blow up an aspirin factory in the Sudan, you know, just to show we're standing tall.
To what extent are we, the American people, constantly taken in by all of this? How is it that we are convinced that there could be a military solution to the problem of the importation of drugs from Colombia?
Well, I think one might put it all together. We have practically no educational system for those who are not rich. Now, if you're not taught geography and you're taught no history at all, or what history you get is false, you aren't prepared to understand why the world works the way it does. I've been reading the American press all my life, and I have never yet read a story favorable to another society. Yes, the Swedes have better education, better health care, daycare centers for working mothers, but they're all alcoholics and they commit suicide. We don't want to be like the Swedes, do we? We're happy with no education and no health care. That's how you keep them down on the farm. So you say, why do the American people put up with it? Well, what alternative do they have? Where are they going to get the information from? They can't get it. They won't be taught it. Other countries have... One of our problems, which is also our glory, has been taking on new people. We have a lot of immigrants. Well, they can be fooled for at least one generation. They'll be slave labor or sweated labor. Then after that, by the second generation, they start to become, you know, as educated as anybody else. I think that, in a way, has kept us from having a culture, a civilization, because we're always starting over again and over again, which is very good for corporate America. And it's some of the children of those immigrants, whether they're boat people or whatever, that are objecting to the to globalization and do object to corporatism.
Listening to this coming from you, a son in many ways of Washington, having grown up here, having rubbed shoulders with virtually everybody in your era and subsequent to your era of living in Washington who has been in power here, a lot of people find that particularly surprising, because they would think that you would be one of those individuals who advocate what is generally being advocated in Washington. Your cousin, and we should point out that this interview is likely to be repeated at some time, but it's initially being conducted in September of the year 2000, when your cousin Al is running for president, but you're not supporting him.
I'm not supporting him. Most of my friends are supporting Nader, but I've done the third party route. I was co-chairman of the People's Party with Dr. Spock, an anti-war party. I don't see much future in that. And I think, as I finally said to the Naderites, at the end of the day, I shall discover that Gore is thicker than Nader.
Gore Vidal, his cousin Al Gore, is running for president of the United States. He said he is not supporting him, even though philosophically he is clearly closer to Ralph Nader than he is to Al Gore. This is Public Interest. I'm Coach O'Nandi. You talk in the book about your conversation with Eleanor Roosevelt in Hyde Park on the issue of jealousy being as close to a reproduction as any historian can get. Would you say that is true for all of the real people in the Golden Age?
Not all of them, because some of them I did not know, so I rely on historians. I mean, I have probably read more American history than anybody outside of an institution. I have to. This is where I get my facts from. With the Golden Age, I lucked in the sense that people like Harry Hopkins, who figures in it greatly, and Eleanor Roosevelt, were all people I knew. In her case, I knew her quite well the last 10 years of her life. I was her neighbor on the Hudson. So if I quote Eleanor on the subject of jealousy, a failing she felt of hers, it will be what she said to me. Now, memory is fallible, And that's why I call my memoirs palimpsest. Palimpsest is writing upon writing upon writing, just scribbling, which printers do on the printer's block. Well, that's the way memory works. If you broke your leg when you're 10 years old, and now, at whatever age you are, you think about breaking your leg, you will not recall the actual breaking of the leg. Your memory works that you will remember the last time you remembered it. Now, if you've thought about it 500 times, maybe, in the course of 30 years, you've got a palimpsest. You've got writing over writing over writing. So anybody who says, rely on, this was exactly what she said to me. Well, we know from courtrooms that no two people ever have the same memory of the common for the.
And, of course, palimpsest is the title of your 1995 autobiography.
Yes.
Or memoir. And there, you would be hard-pressed to find any major figure of historical importance in the part of the 20th century during which you lived, from 1925, that Gore Vidal does not know, did not intersect with in some way or the other. And so Fred Kaplan just came out this year with an authorized biography of your life.
Actually, it was not authorized. I thought it was, but it wasn't.
Oh, explain that, please.
Well, authorized, he certainly has to show it to you. And he wouldn't. And we nearly had a lawsuit over that. But I've never read it. I have no intention of reading it. I've been told enough about it, though.
You approached him about writing it?
No.
Well, what does authorized mean in that context?
I never approached him. I'd never heard of him. He was brought to me. He pretends now that I went to him because he was such a distinguished biographer. Well, I'd never read him. I've still never read him. I have never read his book about me either. I was told that he was a reputable scholar, and there's a vast archive of my letters and so on at a university. And I thought he would do a workmanlike job of getting it all in order. Instead, he sails off. He gives out interviews to the press, you know, how he demanded that I do this and that. It's all perfect nonsense. And then when he didn't show it to me, I nearly pulled the plug on the whole thing. Unfortunately, it's being published by Doubleday, and Doubleday, I'd just gone to Doubleday, it was now my publisher. So I would have to go to a new publisher and kill their biography. So I let it go and just said, well, I don't have to read it.
You haven't read it. Have you talked to anyone about it? Do you get any sense at all of whether or not it was fairly accurate, terribly inaccurate?
Oh, it's very inaccurate. For instance, he can't spell. Now, that sounds kind of funny, but when you're transcribing the names of people in a biography, this is very important. And no editor can help you because they don't know what it was you transcribed. My favorite thing, which somebody pointed out to me, he dedicates the book to his lady wife and to a professor that he had in university. And he misspells the professor's name. Does this fill you with confidence?
Obviously, it doesn't fill Gore Vidal with confidence, him being known to be very particular about things of that nature. The historical novel we're currently discussing with him is the latest and the final in his series on American Empire. It's called The Golden Age. We'll take your telephone calls when we come back after this break. The number again, 1-800-433-8850, our email address, pi@wamu.org. We'll be right back with Gore Vidal.
I'm David First, host of Metro Connection, WAMU's weekly local news magazine. Conventional wisdom tells us that Washington is a transient town, where no one stays for very long. But research shows that 52% of area residents have lived here more than 20 years. Washington is home. And that's why we explore the people, places, history, and events of this area each week on Metro Connection. Join us Saturday morning at 11 o'clock on WAMU 88.5 FM. Support for WAMU is provided by Ink2Me. WAMU, essential to public radio listeners. Ink2Me, essential to the Internet. That's Ink2Me, inktomi.com. Only WAMU can bring you the Lynn Morris Band and Cliff Waldron for free.
It all happens at our annual Pickin' in the Glen concert Saturday, October 7th from noon to 5 at Glen Echo Park in Glen Echo, Maryland. Enjoy an afternoon of live bluegrass and open field pickin' that's fun for the entire family. Visit www.wamu.org for more information. That's Pickin' in the Glen, Saturday, October 7th, noon to 5 from WAMU 88.5 FM. It's the 5th annual Arabian Sights Film Festival, offering some of the newest and finest cinema from the Arab world. Screenings take place during the evenings of this weekend through October 1st. Experience the rich historical, cultural, social, and political dynamics of this region through the medium of film. Screenings are at the Cineplex Odeon Foundry Theater in Georgetown. For information, call 202-724-5613.
Frankly, I've been looking forward to having a conversation with Gore Vidal for some 11 years now. When I saw him narrating a documentary in London in 1989, and so maybe I have so far monopolized too much of the conversation. It's time for me to let our listeners in on this discussion. The historical novel, by the way, is called The Golden Age, and you, Nancy in Washington, are our first caller. You're on the air, Nancy. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Vidal, I wanted to ask you a question. On the one hand, you talk about how our country is too militaristic and everything.
Yes.
And I was wondering why, in light of that, you would support Al Gore as opposed to Nader for president when Gore served in the Clinton administration, which, you know, created, got us into very ruthless slaughter of innocent people in Yugoslavia and Iraq.
Well, Nancy, I totally agree with you. All I said about Cousin Al is I'm not supporting him. I'm not running against him. I disapprove entirely of our military and adventures at Kosovo and in the Sudan and now in Colombia. However, you can't blame Clinton and Gore. This has been the policy of the United States since Harry Truman and his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson. The historian Charles Beard had a great phrase for what we have become. Perpetual war for perpetual peace. We never stop warring.
Nancy, thank you very much for your call. Let's move on to Dominic in Alexandria, Virginia. Dominic, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi, Kojo. Mr. Vidal, how wonderful to have you back in Washington.
Thank you.
I am one of those people who bought that book with the assumption that you were a good part of the making of it. I'm a little disheartened to hear that you are right now distancing yourself from the book.
Well, what I did was answer a lot of questions for him by facts, mostly. So he has a lot of material. And then as he sort of puts it together, I began to see that this was not an authorized book by any means.
Well, it was very enjoyable, regardless.
Oh, well.
It's authorized. I have to ask you, though, you've had so many notorious rows and falling outs with whether it be the Kennedy family or your own mother. Was there anything in your past, or is there anything in your past, that you would have done differently?
No. And you must remember that journalists and academic biographers, like the author that you're referring to now, that's all they can grasp is trouble. They're always looking for confrontations and rows. And I think, particularly with journalists, you know, they think the principal human emotion is theirs, which is envy. And they think that the subject at hand is envious of others. I've always had a rather serene nature. And the rows that I have had were always political in basis. Norman Mailer, an old friend, still a friend. But we had a row over women's liberation.
He wrote a punch-out, as I recall.
Hmm?
A punch-out, as I recall.
He threw a glass at me, and I'm afraid when the press said, why did he throw that glass, instead of explaining about the row over women's liberation, he was against it. I said, once again, words failed him.
Dominic, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Let's move on to James on the cell phone in Georgetown. Hi, James.
Yeah, hi, Kojo. Hello, Mr. Vidal.
Hello.
I have a question relating, actually a two-part question. One relates to, I understand that you were a student at Exeter when you were in high school.
Right.
I'd like to know if you could just comment on the culture of Exeter and how it relates to perpetuating empire. If you could just tell me a little bit about what you saw as the culture there when you were there, and do you know if that's changing? And the second part of my question is, you said that you feel that history is essentially the story of one tribe taking over another's territory. I'm wondering if you feel that the power shift today is occurring because of the new economy, and whether or not you feel as though the powerful are being replaced by those who have access to a more merit-based economic system.
Well, it's certainly true, to go to part two, that the economy is everything, and the shifting now, not so much of the tribes as it used to be historically, with the shifting of vast amounts of money from country to country, company to company, has really skewed the entire world. I mean, a few people, 1% has all the money in the United States. 20% do quite well working for the 1%. 80% are doing rather badly. This is something brand new. And eventually they're going to have to find a way of taxing the great corporations. But since they don't live anywhere, they're international cartels, that have to be taxed at the base, their profits. So far, as they buy all the congresses and parliaments in the world, they don't get taxed. So there's a proposition for the future. Exeter, that's a very shrewd question you ask. That's how our ruling class sustains itself through these schools. I had a stepbrother who was going to inherit a lot of money, so he went to Groton. Groton is where you go in St. Paul's, St. Mark's, if you're going to be a rich boy. And they tried to teach you to have a good character and not marry too often or take to drink. The boys, the bright boys of the ruling class, who are not going to inherit money, of which I was one, are sent to Exeter or to Andor. George Bush Sr. went to Andor.
Yeah.
We are going to work for our rich stepbrothers. They will own the brokerage houses and the banks and the country. And we will be judges, brokers, presidents even, editors of the New York Times. We are the sort of apparatchiks of the big money boys. And that's how we were trained. Service, always hierarchical to the moneyed interests. And empire, I was the head of the America First at Exeter in 1940. And there weren't many boys like me, because I was the grandson of a populist senator, and we were traditionally isolationist. Most of the other kids there were children of the Northeast, bankers and so on, and they were very interventionist. So it was pretty vituperative, the debates that we would have. My principal opponent was T.W. Lamont, whose father appears in my novel, The Golden Age. His father was the head of the House of Morgan. Yes, the House of Morgan. And it was good training for life. If you could master Exeter, the real world seemed awfully simple to me after that.
James, thank you very much for your call. On to Jane. Jane is in Arlington, Virginia. Jane, your turn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am calling because I wanted Mr. Vidal to know what a big impact he's had on me and countless other students. When I was in law school taking a federal courts class, in the beginning of the class, the professor assigned your novel, Burr, to read. And he wanted us to read it because he said, if you just read these old cases about the Supreme Court and the National Bank, the Federal Bank, they're too dry. So I want you to read this novel so you'll understand how much people cared about these ideas and how they lived for these ideas. And we all were sort of skeptical, but your novel just turned us all on. We ended up loving the class, and I am a real fan of reading about American history as a result of that introduction. So I just wanted to let you know what a positive impact you've had.
Well, thank you very much, and I certainly bless your professor.
Oh, yeah.
And the Supreme Court, as you must have learned, originally just did nothing but arbitrage cases.
Right.
And admiralty suits.
Hey, Jane, thank you very much for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
1960, The Best Man opened. It was a play that you wrote for which then-actor Ronald Reagan wanted one of the lead roles. You turned him down, said you didn't think he could pull off the intellectual character of a politician. Well, he became a politician and was president from 1980 to 1988.
But he never pulled off the intellectual aspect as president or as actor. Anyway, the story is not quite right. He was offered to me for the lead, which was then played by Melvin Douglas in 1960 and is now on Broadway with Spalding Gray and Charles Durning.
Elizabeth Ashley, Chris Noth.
And Chris Noth. No, what I said to MCA, who were the agents for Ronald Reagan, I said, he's a very good actor, but I want somebody to suggest Adlai Stevenson, who is both eloquent and brilliant, and a type we don't have much in politics ever, and I don't think have at all now, or at least not this year. And I said, I don't think Reagan would be terribly convincing as a Stevensonian character. Well, the story was too good, so they dropped out Stevensonian. And I don't think he would be credible as a presidential candidate, was what I was quoted as having said. Of course he was.
And became president. This is Public Interest. I'm Kojo Namdi. How does today's cast compare with the cast in 1960?
The cast now is, I think, more interesting because 40 years have passed and actors, by and large, are not terribly interested in politics. Reagan was a rare exception. The 40 years that have passed has taught everybody in the country more than they wanted to know. I mean, you've had Watergate, you've had the Vietnam War, we've had Clintongate, we've had just more immersion in awful politics. And so the actors themselves have just taken it in by osmosis. So they're much smarter to deal with about the parts they're playing.
I've read that as a young man, you wanted to be either president or a writer. You ran for the House in 1960. You ran for the Senate in 1980. Some cynics said you should have been running for president this year in the year 2000. Now that your 20-year gap has passed, you decided not to. Why did you give up on politics?
Well, I wanted to be a politician, and that's the family trade. But I was born a writer. You can't do both. A writer must always tell the truth as he understands it, and a politician must never give the game away. These are two opposing attitudes. So I did run seriously in 60 for the House, and I doubled the Democratic vote. I ran 20,000 votes ahead of Jack Kennedy in this upstate New York district. And then 4 years later, they offered me the nomination again. And I would have been elected, and I didn't want to go to the House, so that was it. In 82, I went into the California primary for Senate to see what was going on, and it was, I could no more, if they came to me and said, if you go through the process of running for president, we'll give you $100 million, and would you do it? And I'd say no. These candidates now, due to the cost of television, they're beggars. They do nothing but pick up telephones and ring strangers and ask for money.
Is that something you'd find difficult, if not impossible, to do?
I am Coriolanus. I could no more do that than I could fly to the moon. And I remember the first thing in the Senate race, in the primary, I was given a list of strangers, and I was supposed to ring them and ask for money. Apparently, Clinton and Gore and Bush all enjoy doing this. I hate it.
Is there any work of your own that you feel stands out as the best example of your craft?
No, I don't think much about what I've written. Once it's written, and there it is. It's for others.
What are you working on now?
I am working on... I'm actually going to do a movie, a remake of a picture I wrote years ago for Betty Davis called The Catered Affair. They want to update it, and I thought it'd be sort of fun since I've just brought back to Broadway The Best Man, and now I'll bring back that movie, and sort of conserving time.
Screenplays, plays, novels, essays, commentaries, television scripts for a while, but the latest historical novel by Gore Vidal is called The Golden Age. Gore Vidal, it has been a pleasure to talk to you, and as I said, I've been looking forward to doing this for many years. I'm an unabashed admirer of your writing. Please continue to do so for as long as you possibly can.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank you very much for joining us. This has been Public Interest. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up in our next hour, it's a Tech Tuesday, and we'll talk about some of the terms you think will be in vogue in the high-tech world.